The Squawker Talker is sponsored by BetOnBrazil.com. It's the betting site for all sports punters with great odds, markets, and offers. Listeners to this podcast can now get up to £60 deposit matched when you use the promo code Squawker60. Just visit BetOnBrazil.com and enter the promo code Squawker60 when you deposit, and we will match your deposit up to £60. Also, look out for our daily happy hour offers between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. Sign up now at betonbrazil.com. Bet on Brazil is for over 18s only. Betting should be fun, so please gamble responsibly.
I'm joined today by award-winning poet, author, and musician Musa Akwanga, whose acclaimed books include A Cultured Left Foot, The 11 Elements of Footballing Greatness, and Will You Manage? The Necessary Skills to Be a Great Manager. Thank you for coming in for an episode of One on One, Musa. How have you been? I saw you at the BBC recording a poem.
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. Thank you for having me on. I was at the BBC earlier recording a poem for the Africa Cup of Nations, so it was a preview for their World Service show. So they kind of wanted me to go and get a bit of the flavour of the tournament.
And you've got your parents are from Uganda, am I right in saying?
That's right, you're absolutely right. They fled Idi Amin's dictatorship in the mid-70s, early 70s that is, and then came to the UK as medical students.
And Uganda back in AFCON for the first time in, how many years is it?
Goodness, I can't, you know, I don't
think
remember.
A good 30 odd years.
Here's a bit of trivia for you. Yeah. So my grandfather used to coach the Uganda national side for several years. He wasn't coaching when they reached the African Nations final in 78, they lost 2-0 to Ghana. I think he was the coach until shortly before then. But yeah, so he's involved in some pedigree of the country's football.
Well, we're going to sort of be discussing your, you know, things that you love about football and your experiences, and also get a chance to hear some of the poems you've written about the sport before. But first of all, we're going to take you on a trip down memory lane here. I saw in your book, A Cultured Left Foot, you talk about how fans, you know, start loving football. And In the chapter Feet, you say, in each fan's life, there is a seminal moment that binds him or her to a particular club for life, which makes them realise they're truly hooked. What I'd like to ask you is, how did you get hooked?
Yeah, so my mum came to the UK and studied at Manchester University. She was a medical student there. So she always talked about United anyway. And I would watch, you know, sort of the games they had on TV back then. I was obviously just a kid. And really sort of crystallised, had that cup run, sort of, I think it was 85, and they had that player, Norman Whiteside, who, if he hadn't been injured, would have been, you know, one of the sort of extraordinary wingers of his time and maybe of all time, and just cuts in off the right flank and bends the ball into the corner, using the defender as a screen. And it was so, the thing about United, I think, at that time, they had this glory streak. There was always this desire of snatching victory where it didn't seem possible. And that always appealed to me. And I think that's why United have this enduring appeal. They're not like Real Madrid. Madrid tend to steamroller teams in big finals. But if you look at United's finals, very few of their finals are actually decisive victories, demonstrations. They're always the kind of the kid who scraps until the last minute and manages to make it through. And there was something very appealing about that, I think, from the very start with United. Yeah.
So you took that on from sort of the 80s, and then there was no like, oh, I'm fascinated by other teams, or was it always United?
Well, it was funny because back then I went to a school called Marish Middle School when I was a sort of primary. And in the playground at that time, everyone supported Villa, Everton. I mean, I think Everton won 2 and 3, 85, 87 league title. And then you had Liverpool winning. I mean, everyone was basically Liverpool, Everton, Villa, Spurs, Arsenal fan. United were one of the last teams of the big teams in the Thames Valley to actually support, but for some reason it was just, they had that, it was that mix of like elegance but also desperation and a kind of faded glamour, and that was appealing. Yeah. And that was enough to carry me through, I think, until Sir Alex turned up one day.
Well, and you've written lots about, you've written poems about football, but sort of taking you back to the beginning, how did you, because there weren't that many footballing poets, I imagine, when you started out, what were your reference points to begin?
That's a great question. I've written poetry since I was about 10 years old, and I've been performing poetry since I was, you know, going to gigs and doing almost like a stand-up type thing since I was about 25. So that's about 12 years I've been performing it. And the idea one day, I can't remember the first football poem I wrote. I think it was actually about Barcelona. Because they inspire, and as pretentious as it sounds, they kind of inspire that. I think it maybe might have been a Barcelona victory. And I was just like, the way they pass, the way they move, this is sort of choreography. It's like orchestra being written. It's like sheet music being written in real time and then performed in real time. And that just appealed. And so I then went off and started just out of nowhere. And there were no real references. I think with poetry, the key is not so much the subject matter as the technique. That's not the key.
So it's applicable to anything, really.
Right, exactly. So I think really the inspirations and my favourite poets are sort of Dante, Dante's Inferno, unbelievable. Milton, obviously. Chaucer, Alexander Pope, Sylvia Plath. You know, the people who can form beautiful images. And they were my kind of guides, really.
Do you know any poets that had written about football before?
I really didn't. I really, because the two worlds don't really overlap. Like poetry is reflective, contemplative. It's seen as quite effete and not very manly and all the rest of that nonsense that football likes to sort of impose on things that aren't football. So there weren't really that many points of reference, if I'm honest.
And you've written about Roy Keane. You're going to give us a sort of recital of the poem about
That's
Keane.
That's right, yeah.
So why Keane? Sort of, what inspired you to do that?
It's funny because I admire, and in so many ways, I admire elegance in football and passing, movement, beating a man off the dribble, beating a man off a short step. But the thing about Keane is it's the will to succeed. I don't know where your allegiances are.
I'm more of an Arsenal fan, but I remember clearly, growing up and seeing Keane as the sort of the anti-Arsenal.
But then for you, it's like Adams and Vieira. Like there were more elegant players than Adams and Vieira.
Yeah.
But the will to win is the thing that I think carried United forward. And I think that Keane embodied that. He embodied what Ferguson was trying to achieve, the spirit of never giving up, failure never being an option, and even success not being that enjoyable because you're always looking to the next success. And that's why I find Keane so compelling. Keane, to me, is the most compelling footballer and maybe even figure to have come through Manchester United since I've been supporting them. And that includes Ferguson. I find Keane more intriguing than anyone, I think.
Could you compare him to anyone playing today in the current Man United team?
I could barely compare Keane to anyone I'd seen play professional sport. I think in football, the only comparison would have been someone like Lothar Matthäus in terms of that force of nature, the combination of power, technique, desire, because Keane's technique was underrated. The passing, Keane's short passing was on a different level. There's no one I've seen with his desire in major sport, with the exception of perhaps, I would say, Michael Jordan.
And the title of this poem is The Tempest.
Yes.
As well. So without further ado, let's hear it.
Sure, okay, let me explain how I wrote this. So there's a electronic group called Lawn, and they've got a track called, I think, called Cherry Tree. And whenever I write poems, I often listen to a piece of music that embodies the person. And this is like a really driving, aggressive piece of electronic music. And the poem is really about the tempest, Roy Keane being this kind of uncontrollable force that you can't deny. So it goes like this. Hail to the tempest for Roy Keane. Hail to the tempest, for he was relentless. Furious as a chainsaw, rage was his engine. He'd take the terrain, each vein full of vengeance. His was the first head raised from the trenches. This man's most famous adventure saw a midfield blown away when he entered. His trip booked halfway to the bench, this big game hunter slayed a Juventus. The patron saint of the clenched fist. Yes, his stare scared flames into embers. Hated, courageous, dangerous, the centre of a decade of Red Satan adventures. Part devilish. When he greeted a kneecap, it seemed that he relished it. Keane, his name was an understatement, since he was the definition of what obsessive is. His temper wasn't short, it was sawn off. Shooting his jaw off at prawns and all sorts, his mouth put his game in jeopardy, more than any maiming in plain sight of referees. Still, he departed into lore and legend, with the short pass and stormy glance as his surest weapons. Keane, whether you were for or against him, he was the tempest. You could not prevent him.
And so what now inspires you to write about football? What are the issues that, you know, you care deeply about?
Football generally, I suppose the infrastructure of the game, access, fairness for different players from different places. So,
because you've been vocal about sort of issues surrounding race and
absolutely,
and sexuality.
I've talked about race a lot and sexuality a lot. I only think because we talk about, you know, the global game, but if we really enfranchised everyone who was good enough to make it, we'd have a much better game. We'd have even better players. I mean, how many Messis would we see if, well, Messi's of his own type, but how many players approaching the level of Messi would we see if people had a fair opportunity? I look at N'Golo Kante, for example. This is a guy that's bounced around the lower leagues for years and was rescued basically by good scouting. How many amazing players have been denied opportunity for different reasons, sexuality, race, and the rest of it? So my passion at this point is really providing greater access and also greater voices on the journalism side as well. Mm.
So you do you feel that in this current landscape allows a player, you know, these kind of people who've been disenfranchised to come to the fore and actually come out, you know, if they are, you know, homosexual or something like that, or if, you know, black players, if they want to talk about issues of race in the public forum, are they allowed to, or are they still, is football still not quite ready for it?
I think actually, cynically speaking, I think market forces have been really valuable in that sense, because you have big players who are speaking out. I mean, look at the NBA, for example. You've got LeBron James talking about race issues. You have Yaya Toure. I know he's had a sort of tarnished recent few months, but Yaya Toure is someone who's spoken about race very openly. Lilian Thuram. And players, I think, are free to do that because they generate these huge sums of money. Mm. You know, Neymar and Dani Alves can talk about racism because who is going to censure Neymar and Dani Alves? They are market makers. And it's really great those players have taken the initiative and created a platform for others. So I feel positive about, and there's always more we can do, but I feel positive that the situation is being addressed.
And how did you feel about the Rainbow Laces campaign as well?
Actually, I had issues with it because Paddy Power were behind, I think, the initial iteration of it. I'm not sure if they did the latest one. But I liked it. I think, actually, if people can be comfortable speaking about these issues and can talk about them publicly, that's the beginning to a solution, yeah. I think.
What did you see about the social media reaction to those? I mean, what you saw was the clubs changing their profile pictures with the rainbow flag in the background or similar sorts. But then you'd see fan bases kind of slightly divided over the issue.
You're always going to get, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, social media, as we know, is very performative, I mean, by its own nature. And so there are sometimes things that people would say in public they wouldn't say to your face, and sometimes people tweet stuff that... this is the problem. People can create an atmosphere of great hostility than there actually is. So I'm always wary of judging the success of a campaign by the social media response, simply because I think you find the very best and the very worst on social media. But I'm glad to see that it was shared so widely and actually in many cases approvingly.
Definitely true, yeah. So, and talk about Man United. What's inspiring you about Man United this season? Is it, you know, we're talking a lot about... Pogba as well.
Oh yeah, I was going to say Pogba. We just have to start with Pogba. I mean, that guy has an astonishing range of talent. He has the kind of the range of skills of a Gerrard, Steven Gerrard, and also as a Yaya Toure. These are these sort of players that can really do everything. But also like almost a Toni Kroos. You know, Toni Kroos, who has this wonderful ability to play as the 8, as the 6, as the 10. Who can play the pass, the long pass, the short pass, who can score in a Pogba, but yeah, I suppose an energetic version of Toni Kroos, which is a terrifying thought, really, because Kroos himself is an extraordinary player.
So what is the best game you've seen live now? You're living in Berlin. Do you get to see Bundesliga games
best
as well?
Best I've seen live was Brazil. Still is the second game I ever saw. It's just Brazil-Holland. Yeah.
How old are you?
I was 14 years old, 1994, at the Cotton Bowl in Dallas. I was at the end where Dennis Bergkamp scored twice in 5 minutes.
Wow.
And I was standing, I was sitting, it was a perfect view actually. I was sitting directly behind the goal that Holland were attacking in the second half. And I can tell you this thing, Romario's first touch has to be seen to be believed. Jorginho hit a crossfield pass and Romario had a guy on his shoulder and the ball dipped just before the touchline and he brought it down as if he was catching it in his hand. I've never seen anything like that. I mean,
replicated since, or
it's Romario. I haven't seen technique. Romario is probably one of the five most skillful centre forwards the world has seen. I mean, that guy had a technique that we can't even. I mean, he would juggle the ball off his shins, for goodness sake.
I mean, obviously people remember him, but he's kind of become a cultish figure rather than the sort of the people
but he's now a politician. Romario is now a politician in Brazil, so he's now doing a lot of lobbying. And a really quite impressive guy, and very vocal about corruption in Brazil as well. So we really missed out. I think the YouTube era really missed out on a player like that. But yeah, that's the best game I've still seen, I think.
And what would you say? Oh, do you see Bundesliga games as well? Or at the moment?
I haven't seen a Bundesliga game yet. I've seen quite a few championship type games. The local team in Berlin is called Union Berlin. There's like about four or five teams in Berlin, but they're my favourite one. They're the kind of like
not Hertha.
Poor Hertha. I can't. There's no real. Sorry, I apologise to any Hertha listeners on this podcast. Just that they have a kind of love hate relationship with the city because Hertha fans are like very passionate, but Berlin's not a very passionate football town, and so it's really strange. You've got this massive stadium, but the kind of the accompanying passions aren't always there. Not from the Hertha fan base, but from the rest of the surrounding city. So they're kind of a bit out on a limb to an extent, the poor Hertha fans.
Well, and you play yourself in Germany as well. What's the team you play for?
I'm playing for a great team called SFC Friedrichshain Internationale, or called Inter SFC F Inter. I am the fourth choice striker. Last season, I scored 3 goals in 10 games. I'll have you know.
Very good.
It's a decent record, actually. I was coming off the bench, and I still come off the bench this year. I haven't scored this year. We got promoted to the top league in the city. Basically, it's the top amateur league in the country. We got promoted after penalty shootout playoff last year. We're struggling this year. We've won 2 and lost 6. So just about the relegation zone. So fingers crossed we'll stay up.
And you also played for Stonewall as well.
Yes, Stonewall.
Are you still involved or not?
So Stonewall, for those who don't know, Stonewall is a football team for gay players and gay-friendly players, and I identify as bisexual. So I played for them for 2.5 years as a defensive midfielder, which I had never done before. I turned up and they gave me the number 4 shirt. I don't play for them anymore, but we're still very good friends with all the sort of the people down there. Great club.
Yeah. And do you, I mean, I remember I was watching another video of you speaking about these issues and having actual games against people who weren't LGBT.
Yeah.
And some pretty strange experiences going on there.
Yeah, there's a couple of those if I can share them. So we're playing against one team and it's a bit mean of me, but there was one guy and he was just digging. It was a bit too much of a dig. And I was like, this guy is kind of, I can sense he's a bit homophobic. Like, there's something about this dude. Like, so the game went on. He was being more and more aggressive and needling a bit and all these little kicks. And I eventually just said to him, dude, you're losing 2-0. What are you going to tell your girlfriend? And he just lost it. And within 2 minutes, I'd scored and it was 3-0. And we just basically did them. And it was funny because he completely melted down. And I said, my philosophy was basically this. He's probably been sitting the entire week going, we're going to play the Puffs this week. And then he played us and we were a really good team and we had like 9 different nationalities. The thing about playing for a gay football team is that you basically have a catchment area of the entire homosexual population of London. And that is like, you basically have the pick. We had like 2 Brazilian players, we had a Japanese right wing back who was unbelievable, you know, Chinese left back. We had the pick of gay London. So we had a really good team. I think we played Middlesex County Premier League. It's good, you know, good standard.
Yeah. So now we're going to hear your messy poem, which you've brought in for us as well, which I'm very looking forward to hearing. Well, why messy?
Well, I guess why not? I mean, messy really does inspire poetry. The way he plays, and you know, Messi's one of those few players who does things that I've never seen before. Watching him, I think that's why we watch football, isn't it? We watch something for not just the familiar, not just for the familiar crowd roar or seeing our favourite players make slide tackles, but we watch football for invention. And I think since Ronaldinho, no one has invented the game like Messi has. But there's also something about Messi's brilliance, which is the monotony of it. And I thought, how do I capture that? And I thought, well, Messi's so brilliant, but he's brilliant almost every week. I mean, even last night, he scored against Bilbao, that free kick.
I saw a tweet today. Someone was saying, 2017 is going to be Messi's year. And the reply to it was, what, there was a year that wasn't?
Yeah. A year has got four figures is Messi's year. That's basically how it rolls at this point. We'll be talking about Messi for the next, as long as civilization exists. Even after football has bored us and we're amongst the stars, we're going to remember that guy. I mean, yeah. So this is the poem. It's
what's the title of it?
It's called Just Another, because it's just another year. Just another year for Messi, really.
Rather apt.
Yeah, absolutely. So here we go, Just Another, for Leo Messi, and it goes like this. I guess that, for Messi, each goal is just another. They come to him as sun does to summer. Just another low drive with the right or left, or the odd lob or deft touch with head or chest. Just another night making his rival number drift past like a ship with a busted rudder. Just another soul left in his slipstream by his light speed shift up from 0 to 60. Just another free kick from 30 yards that will swerve like the letters of his autograph. Or another free kick sneak beneath the wall. Or a hand ball that gives our praise the briefest pause. Just another hat-trick scored. Just another home crowd's ecstatic roar. Just another dribble that will dazzle all. Watch this juggernaut clutch another Ballon d'Or.
And now Messi, he's produced a lot of magic moments of his own, but I wanted to ask you, what are your own ultimate magic moments in football that you've experienced? Maybe there could be like the little tiny sort of glimpses or just the actual match themselves.
At which level? Like watching, playing?
Or overall, yeah, from bottom to top.
You know what? I was having this conversation with a friend just the other day. There have been, actually, I suppose there are two. One is negative and one's, well, they're both positive, but they came from a negative moment. So back at uni, won the league title. I was at St. John's College at Oxford. We had a brilliant team that year. We got relegated the next year because we lost 9 players. They all graduated and left.
That's the face of a uni team. Yeah.
But this team we had at uni, we'd won one, drawn one, and lost one of the first three games. And the fourth game was against St. Catherine's College, right? And we had to win. We were 2-1 down. I think they won their first three games. And one of their midfielders racially abused one of our midfielders. He called him a black C-U-N-T. And there were three black guys on that team, me and two other guys, and we lost it. And we just took our game to a different level. Mm. And within 5 minutes, we were winning 3-2.
But you didn't react in the kind of violent way. You just said, let's get on with this and beat them.
I'll name names. There's a guy called Mark Charamutu, our central midfielder, who I think was of Mauritian descent. Mark, he racially abused Mark. Mark took possession 2 minutes later and walked through the centre circle. I kid you not. He didn't jog. He basically walked through the centre circle, sidestepping people, sped up, edge of the box, round the keeper and scored. 2 minutes later.
What was your reaction?
Oh, we just went, it was complete bedlam. And we were so wired. We were just wild. I've never challenged, I think before or since, racial abuse so effectively and powerfully. And I was playing out of my skin. I was playing up front at that point. I was still quick back then. So I set up the winner with a flick on. So that was one of my great moments in terms of a feeling of team spirit.
Yeah.
The second most amazing feeling I think I've had in the football pitch was actually last year. Well, in football. I would say in football because I feel more connected to games that I am with and play in. So I was an unused sub for the playoff final when our team got promoted to the first division. Now, our captain, who I play with in Berlin, had gone into hospital with cancer. He got diagnosed with cancer with 5 games left at the end of the season. So he was basically in a hospital bed until the last game when he coached. And he coached us to a victory in a German penalty shootout. He's Australian, but German. I'll never forget this moment because our penalty taker that won us the entire match is German himself. And he's an economics graduate at Cambridge. He basically planned how to score the penalty in the shootout to win the game. And so German, planning it all out. He then went and asked permission of our captain to take the penalty that way. Because he was like, the keeper's 6'5" and he's diving to either corner perfectly. I'm going to go directly down the middle and punch it down the middle. And he did. And it's exactly what happened. And we won. And we just cleared the benches and promoted. And it was in the sort of local papers and local websites. So, yeah. So those are the two greatest moments I've experienced in football.
And now, who is the most inspirational person you've come across in football? It could be a player or
Carlos Alberto.
Right away, Carlos Alberto.
I met him.
Who sadly passed away this year, of course.
Yes, I met him in 2014.
Well, last year. So, yeah.
He's an amazing human being. When you meet a captain, the role of the captain is sometimes overstated, I think. But when you meet him, when I met him, it was really strange. It was an iconic moment. I was discussing it today. I said, it's very rarely you get to talk to someone who defined a large part of the modern world. I mean, he defined, that Brazil 70 team as it's the zenith.
How did he define?
Well, that fourth goal that he scored, he described the fourth goal that he scored in the final goal that he scored in that World Cup final, because there's that amazing moment when Pelé passes it square and Carlos Alberto runs onto it and hits this amazing sort of, outside of the right foot strike. Mm.
That kind of goal, yeah.
And we were like, what was going on there? Pelé didn't look at you. And he was like, he knew. I've played with Pelé at Santos for hundreds of games, so he knew the run I'd be making. And if you actually watch that goal again, Pelé doesn't look up for the last 5-6 seconds of the move. He gets the ball, I think, from either, was it Tostão or it was Cherzinho, gets the ball from. And he lays it square at the perfect speed. And Carlos Alberto hits it 2 inches off the ground and just rips it. And he was so proud of that moment. We went to his house, we interviewed him in his house in Rio in 2014 in March, this BBC documentary. You can hear it, it's called The Burden of Beauty. It's a 2-part doc that I presented. But he was incredibly humble, he was incredibly gentle, generous, And you could see why he'd been trusted with the armband. You could see it, like this man that was given the job of stewardship. So he, to me, was inspirational because it wasn't about him, it was about the team. And he was an outstanding player in his own right, but you could, he had this aura. And it, aura is a cliche, but this guy had it in spades.
And beyond his football career as a player, what did he go on to do?
Well, he basically kind of became an ambassador for the game. Did a lot of sort of promo work. Lived in a very was well off when he wasn't loaded, but he was well off when he finally passed away, and I think they took care of him pretty well. He must have some good business interests as well. Yeah. But basically, was a kind of like of late night, guest on TV and was welcome everywhere he went. Yeah. And right, I mean, he was like royalty. We couldn't get a cab back into Rio. Here's a quick story about what an amazing guy he was. We couldn't get a cab back into Rio after interviewing him. And it was, by then it was rush hour. It's like 6:30 in Rio, which is a nightmare. So he gets in his car and drives us around in 20 minutes of traffic, trying to flag us a cab down. And eventually people are like, wait, there's Carlos Alberto is driving around. So eventually like a cab driver was like, of course, stopped and was like, oh yeah, of course. And gets us in and he waves us off, make sure we're safely in the cab. Then he goes off. Mm. And like he drove through, I mean, can you imagine seeing, I mean, there's not even a comparison to it.
Yeah.
If you name an iconic figure like that, it would be like getting a cab ride of David Beckham or something. It was that iconic. But that was the guy. He was completely unassuming and really gentle. And it was a lesson to me because it was like, this is one of the greatest players that ever lived in any sport. And he's as humble as anyone I've met in football.
And do you talk about him in your books at all?
No, because the last book I wrote about football was in 2010. I'm planning an update of A Culture Left Foot with more stats. I'll be talking to the Squawker guys about that.
Sure.
No, I'm really sick. I would like to talk to you guys about it. But the last book I wrote was in 2010, so he missed out on that. But I'd love to mention anecdotes about his leadership in anything new that I write.
And finally, this is something we ask guests, who, particularly authors who come in. What are your free books, free football books that we have to read?
Oh, what an amazing question. The funny thing is, I think two of them are even Dutch. Ajax Barcelona Cruyff by Frits Barend and Henk van Dorp, basically a book of interviews with Johan Cruyff. Second book.
Well, because the Cruyff book that came out this year.
Yes, I've not read that yet.
The reaction to that was a bit sort of mixed.
Did it hit the mark?
Are there stuff that are in it as sort of slight fabrications or sort of, anyway, I don't know if you, Mo Alim.
Really?
Yeah, he was sort of slightly sort of quizzing it like that.
But. Well, Ajax Barcelona Cruyff is a bit older and it's just a series of interviews with Cruyff. And it's really amazing because it's sort of unfiltered. That great quote from Cruyff, if I'd want you to understand, I would have explained it better. I mean, it's just full of gems like that. So that's an amazing book. And these are ones that spring to mind. Second book, I would say David Winner's Brilliant Orange, which is, I mean, David Winner is someone I've had the privilege to get to know as a football writer.
Why is that so great?
It's so good because it articulates so well the relationship between Dutch football and Dutch culture. And the fact that the Dutch game could not really have developed in anywhere other than Holland. Mm. You know, the flat spaces, the kind of provincial, homely, family-oriented culture, you know, it really emerged out of that. So that's an amazing book in terms of anthropology.
It's a bit sad that the Dutch football at the moment isn't quite where it should be.
These things are cyclical, though, and there's also market forces to consider. You know, the sheer amount of money that is now in football means that the Dutch model is difficult to compete with, far better financed. As these days, you can just buy a player of that level off the shelf, which you could do before, but now the globalization of football means that you can get that talent anywhere at any time. So it was always a losing battle for the Dutch, but they're still acquitting themselves fairly well. The third book, again, cliche city, but it might even be a Dutch, it might even be Simon Cooper, Football Against the Enemy, competing neck and neck with, you have to mention, Jonathan Wilson's Inverting the Pyramid at some point in the running.
Are you a big fan of tactics and sort of analysis like that?
That book was seminal. You know, it's more of a kind of Apocalypse Now as opposed to a Star Wars. Like, you wouldn't keep digging into.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You watch Star Wars any time, Apocalypse Now,
it's not as accessible as well. I think just to a sort of.
No, only because.
It should be, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think because of the tactical nature of it. But I will say this, there are football clubs that read that. There are managers who read that and absorb that. Mm. You know, that is a seminal. He achieved something big with that book. So I suppose, the Ajax book, the David Winnerbook and I think Wilson as well are probably the three that I would put up there.
Well, I think that's all we've got time for today, but absolute pleasure to having you in.
Pleasure's mine. Thank you for having me in. Much. Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
And what are you going to be working on next? You know, what are your next projects?
Oh, well, there's a guy called Rio Virkel. Rio Virkel is actually the right back for my football team in Germany, in Berlin. He also happens to be one of the best sports talkers in the world. And he's frequently out photographing for Nike and Adidas. And we're working on a collection of football poems. So he basically sends me three photos every week. I pick one of them, write a poem about it, and we put it on Medium. And then we've been compiling about 40 of them now. We want to do a massive competition book at some point.
Did you find that easy to receive an image? Because when I actually a little secret for listeners, when I was at school, I did a little bit of English. And in that, we did great writing and writing poems. But we would be given paintings as well. And I was there was a Mark Rothko painting, which was just black and white. And then you'd have to write a poem about it.
Rothko's got a great thing on in the Tate right now. If you go to the Tate Modern right now, Rothko's got a great little exhibition on. Actually, it's funny you should mention that, because I think the beauty of poetry is responding instantly to images. And I think that's kind of what we're going back to with this project I'm working on now.
Ah, that'd be good to see. And your books, The Cultured Left Foot and How We Manage, are they available on Amazon? Or?
That's right, available on Amazon. The other piece of news is that I've actually recently acquired the rights to A Cultured Left Foot. So I'm looking to do maybe a 10th anniversary edition of it with new interviews, new stats, all the rest of it. So the next time it's on sale, it'll probably be for my own website, which is okwonga.com, mysurname.com. But yeah, I'll keep you posted on that.
Lovely. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
I'll be back on the 25th of January with veteran of football journalism, John Dillon. Thank you very much for listening. I'll catch you in a fortnight. Goodbye for now.